Welcome to the Power of Attorney Project, which is part of our Conversations That Matter podcast. My name is Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. This podcast is intended to provide general information only and is not intended to be a substitute for seeking personalized legal, financial, or other advice. This podcast raises issues that our audience can further explore on their own in their own local communities with their own local experts. This project will help to be a call to action for families to solve their issues, find solutions to their problems, and have greater peace of mind.
And today's podcast title is called Appointing Multiple People, Benefits and Pitfalls. And our guest speaker today is Lisa Felstein, and she practices health law. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, Mary. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. Could you share a bit about your practice with our audience, please?
Sure. So my background as a health lawyer started off with giving advice to hospitals and other health sector clients. And I transitioned about a year and a half ago with my own practice, and now what I call my niche family health law. So what that means is that I give health law advice and representation to caregivers and individuals, so people who are dealing with the healthcare system in their capacity as substitute decision makers or attorneys or guardians, because I realized that there were not many lawyers giving advice to those individuals. Myself and most of my colleagues were advising the institutions and the care providers. So that involves a variety of different areas of law that all come together with the theme of helping family caregivers.
That's wonderful. And just to let our audience know that you practice in the province of Ontario.
Yes, I do. So my comments today will be based on Ontario law, although the theme of appointing multiple attorneys, some of the factors that we discuss and the considerations will be relevant in other provinces, but definitely should be discussed with lawyers in each jurisdiction to make sure that it's all applicable.
And that's great, Lisa. Thank you for mentioning that, because it is a common issue across the country, but people can listen to this podcast and then go back to their own local lawyer, perhaps in Alberta or New Brunswick, and say, how does that relate to where we live? So they can learn from what you say today and go back and have personalized, confidential conversations with their own lawyers. So thank you for that. I have a series of questions, and let's get started. My first one is, when a lawyer is drafting up POA documents, why might you want to have more than one person appointed?
So there are actually a number of reasons why you might want to have more than one person appointed as the attorney, and they really fall into two categories. One is for your own benefit, and the other is for the benefit of the person or people that you're appointing. So in terms of your own benefit, when you look at the skills of the people or person that you're appointing, it may be that some people in your life are more suited to making personal care decisions, and others might be more suited to making financial decisions under a power of attorney for property. So it could be beneficial to appoint more than one person, maybe two people, so that you touch the different skill sets that you would need, because as you've mentioned in other podcasts, there's a power of attorney for personal care and power of attorney for property. So if you put two people on both, it's important to make sure the people you've named have the skills and abilities to carry out your decisions. But the alternative is to appoint one person under each of those power of attorney. So the person who has the personal care skills, maybe they're a healthcare professional or they're more comfortable with medical terminology or being involved in those kinds of decisions, maybe appoint one person for the power of attorney for personal care, and a person in your life that has the skills to manage your finances could be the person appointed under the power of attorney for property. So that's for your own benefit to make sure you've got the right skill set. And I have actually done that for my own. I appointed my husband, but after that, as the substitute, I appointed my mother under my personal care power of attorney. And for my power of attorney for property, I appointed my father because he's a chartered accountant. So just based on their skill set, to me, that made sense. And the other benefit is practically there are checks and balances. If you do appoint more than one person, it's less likely someone will take advantage. And we all like to think the person that we're appointing is trustworthy, but I've seen in my practice that is not always the case. So having more than one person can increase the chance that our decisions will be followed, money will not be used inappropriately or stolen. And then the second subset is for the benefit of your family. It can be useful to name more than one person because being an attorney can be a very busy job. It can be a burden. So sometimes having more than one person available to attend appointments or sign checks to just make the job a little bit easier. I actually have one client. She was very concerned about the burden she was creating because her daughter has a young family of her own. So she wanted to try to structure her affairs in a way that wouldn't be too time consuming for her daughter. And then finally, multiple attorneys can be useful in terms of perceptions of fairness. Definitely, when we choose one person and exclude others, and in particular a parent that maybe chooses one child as the attorney and not the other, there can be a perception of unfairness or feeling excluded. So for some people, they want to choose multiple attorneys so that nobody feels left out. And that inclusiveness can sometimes help avoid fighting at the outset.
Okay, that's very interesting. So what are the risks of appointing more than one person?
So that's a great question because where there are benefits, there are often risks or pitfalls, and sometimes the benefits outweigh the risks, and sometimes they don't. So it's definitely important to think through the risks as well. Some of the risks are actually for the attorneys themselves. Depending on how the power of attorney is drafted in particular, it might be one attorney is able to make decisions without the other. And as I mentioned previously, there can be a benefit. Maybe someone signs a check. It's practical. But the flip side is somebody could be making decisions or taking actions that are inappropriate and expose the other attorney to liability. So that's a risk for the attorney. And also, if there's more than one person, if they don't agree, there can become family conflict can flow from that. Litigation might flow from that. So if they don't agree, that can be very challenging, whereas one person has the freedom and independence to make decisions on their own. And the other risk is delay. Practically, even if everybody may agree, it can just take time, a hospital calling three people to go through a treatment that's being proposed, obtain informed consent, have three different phone calls. That can take time, and that might be time that really doesn't exist in a healthcare situation where time is of the essence. And it can also just create delay in terms of everybody trying to reach consensus if they don't agree. Even if it's not litigious and there's not fighting, but talking through the issues can take time for everybody to get on the same page. Particularly if there's a power of attorney for personal care that has one attorney and power of attorney for property appoint someone else, those two attorneys may have inherent conflicts. I mean, the example I often give is making a decision about something like home care or long-term care that has a cost associated with it. The attorney for personal care will be focusing on the personal care aspects and what home care might provide, and maybe it's the person's wish to stay in the home as long as possible. And the attorney for property is focusing on the bottom line. How much is this going to cost? You know, X might be a cheaper option. And so there can be this inherent conflict that slows down the process.
And here's a real life question for you. What happens if there is more than one person appointed and they do not agree with each other?
So that does happen, and those are some of the people that end up in my office. A big part of my power of attorney practice is not just drafting them, but helping family members who don't agree. And there are sort of two categories of how they can be resolved. One, the first category is looking at the document. That's the first step. What does the power of attorney say? Sometimes, and it's excellent when they do this, sometimes they have clauses in there that anticipate disagreements, and that's wonderful because that gives direction for the attorneys. One type of clause that I've seen, you know, a tiebreaker clause, is what happens if the two people, if there's two, need a tiebreaker. And sometimes it can be that there's three attorneys, and then it might be majority rules, but if there's two, sometimes people give a veto power to one of the attorneys. They hope that they'll agree, but if not, they choose one over the other to have the final say. Sometimes it can direct the attorneys to seek out mediation, Or another option is a third-party binding decision. So I recently had a client who appointed her sons as the decision makers, as the attorneys. But in the event they could not agree, they had to ask her husband whose decision would be binding. So that's one option. And the first option always is look at what the document says. There might be guidance, and it's great if there is. And if there isn't, the attorneys have to sort it out themselves. And that might be through negotiation. They might just be able to talk it through, consult other family members, maybe even flip a coin. They could decide to go to mediation, whether hiring a professional mediator or choosing someone they know. Sometimes it could be that they have to go to litigation, although that's really a last resort. But somebody could try to outrank the other by becoming the guardian, although there would have to be very serious circumstances for that to happen. And then under the Healthcare Consent Act, there can be situations where if the two attorneys for personal care can't agree about a decision, and this can happen, especially for really significant decisions like withdrawing life support, it could be that in the end, the public guardian and trustee is called upon to decide. And either the PGT decides or the two attorneys are finally forced to reconcile because they don't want the decision to be in the hands of someone who doesn't know their loved one. So those are sort of the two categories, is look to the document and then otherwise do your best to figure it out and hopefully do it in a way that balances the wishes of the loved one and also doesn't create a negative impact on the family. Because unfortunately, when the two people disagree, that can be the cracks that begin a family falling apart. And it's very sad to see that those disagreements can have such a negative impact on families, but they do.
Thank you for that, Lisa. So, what flexibility is there after a POA is signed to increase the number of people responsible? For example, what can a person do if they feel they should have been appointed? Or, if you are appointed, can you bring on another person to also be responsible?
So the first question in there is the easy one. The person who makes the power of attorney can make a change to increase or change the attorneys, change really at all, at any time, provided that they are still capable. And so capable is a legal concept, but it does refer to mental capacity. There's a certain minimum capacity a person must have in order to make a power of attorney. And they, as long as they have that capacity that they did when they first made it, if they still have it, they can make changes. But that's the easy question. The harder question, whether a person who was not appointed and feels they ought to have been, or somebody who was appointed and wants to bring on someone else. So the short answer is that other than the person making the power of attorney, no one else can change the power of attorney. I can't say my brother should have been appointed or why was my brother appointed? I ought to have been appointed. We can't go ahead and change it, but there are other options to either involve other people in the decision-making process or to hold the attorney accountable if there's a concern there. So to involve others, a power of attorney may actually permit delegation or assignment. More often than not, I find that they are silent on this, but sometimes they do mention it. And I think it can be useful to mention it. I actually had a client whose daughter was very upset because she was relying on one daughter so heavily that the other daughter's perception was she's not, you know, just relying on her. She's delegating her job, and that's not okay. So instead, it can be useful to actually address delegation right in the document, actually, where, for example, I had a client recently. She expressly said, my daughter-in-law is a physician, and there are circumstances where I want her to be involved. And in this case, she didn't delegate decision-making, but she expressly said, I want her to be involved. She can help explain the medical terminology and play a useful role to support the attorney. And that can be useful if it's anticipated that there might be some sort of family conflict, to expressly turn your mind to delegation or assignment of decision-making power. But to involve others, the attorney can still seek input. Attorneys can go to lawyers or accountants or relatives. And in actual fact, under the Substitute Decisions Act, there can be legal requirements to consult with supportive family members who are in regular contact with the incapable person. So there are options to involve other people if the attorney wants to seek that input. and then to hold the attorney accountable. Although it's not possible to just jump on the power of attorney per se, the attorney can be held accountable through a process called passing of accounts, which involves going to court, but basically it means having the attorney show the records of what decisions have been made, what's been done, and that can be useful if there's a concern the attorney is exploiting the loved one. Of course, police can always be called if there's concerns involving theft or anything like that or elder abuse. And then somebody can apply to become a guardian and outrank the attorney, and that can be through the courts, but it's an option if in the event that somebody's taking advantage of their position as attorney and somebody else thinks they need to be held accountable. So the bottom line is there are options that the law provides, even though we can't add on others or get ourselves added on per se.
Okay, thank you for that. And my final question is, how can some of the risks of multiple people being appointed be mitigated?
So that is such an important question because it's proactive rather than reactive. So for anybody listening who's maybe tuned out, I hope they this catches their attention again, because this is where a lot of problems can be resolved. And in my practice, often people come to me for advice and the family is already in conflict. And I do often think to myself, if only the power of attorney had addressed X. And so drafting it, we often treat the document as the cherry on top when doing our wills, and that is really not okay, because there's so much that can go into the document and it should be taken seriously as its own standalone important legal document. So I'll give a number of examples of how risks can be mitigated if appointing multiple attorneys. One is the tiebreaker clause. Again, the examples I gave before, whether that's mediation, giving one person veto power, appointing someone as the third party decision maker whose decision is binding. There's a number of options available, but include something. If there are multiple attorneys, give them guidance. Don't leave them stuck to resolve the situation. It can get time consuming, it can get expensive, and it can get nasty. So definitely figure out a strategy to give guidance for breaking ties. Another way to mitigate risk is thinking through, there's legal language, joint and several. Your lawyer, people's lawyers can explain it to them. But the short is that thinking through whether decisions can be made independently by the attorneys or if they must be unanimous, whether checks and balances are desirable or whether that independence is desirable for convenience. There isn't always one right answer, but it's important to think through for your family and the people that you're appointing whether they should be allowed or not allowed to have some independence in terms of making decisions. Clear communication, that cannot be understated, and I mean in the document and in person. Sometimes someone will make a power of attorney and they won't tell anybody in their family, and that can be a situation ripe for conflict. It can be very useful to sit the family down, explain why you've chosen somebody, especially if you've chosen one child and not others, or maybe there's four children and you've selected two, to explain your reasons and let them hear from you, let them ask questions, and so that after the fact it doesn't come as a surprise and they don't feel offended. And likewise, I encourage clients to include reasons right in their document. Because sometimes we really do have reasons why someone is included or excluded, and putting those reasons can help increase the chance that should the document be challenged, their reasons are clear. And also, you know, in terms of looking at their intention, it's less likely to be found otherwise. And also in terms of making people feel that they understand the reasons, that can really make a difference. Think through personalities and family dynamics and whether it makes sense to appoint multiple people or not. Sometimes people think if they appoint two people who don't get along, they'll keep each other honest. That's a line many lawyers have heard, and unfortunately it can often backfire because those two people have a very difficult time reaching decisions. So think through personalities. Sometimes rather than appointing two people at once, one of those can just be the substitute. So in the event the first attorney is incapable or for some other reason, you know, unwilling, etc., then there's a substitute, but they don't actually have to work together. So that can be useful, but really, really think through the family dynamics and don't make decisions just to please people if they're not going to be able to get along. And finally, giving some detail. Powers of attorneys far too often are one-page documents completely lacking detail. And that's really hard because situations arise and the decision makers are not sure what to do and can have their own ideas of what their loved one would have wanted. So give details where you know a specific wish, include it. Or if you don't know every, you know, we can't predict everything, but give priorities. Maybe spending money on home care is more important than anything, and you would rather deplete your estate and be able to stay in your home. Or maybe there's some sort of value, like autonomy and independence is really important. So whatever detail that can be provided is great. It makes the job of the attorneys much easier because they don't have to engage in guesswork when there's some specific instruction. So all of those things can be done right in the power of the attorney. And then finally, the attorneys themselves, if they find that they've been appointed and they're working with someone else, those risks can be mitigated from the outset a little bit by planning ahead how decision making could be divided, maybe how disputes can be resolved. And then finally, my last tip for risk mitigation is keeping others in the loop so that they're not left wondering. And a great example recently is I was speaking with one individual who was worried his two siblings that were appointed, he was not. He was worried his two siblings would make a decision to withdraw life support. And he would wake up one day with the phone call that his mother was gone and he was kept out of the loop simply because he was not included as an attorney. And that started to create division within the family, people picking sides, a lot of conflict, a lot of fear. So especially when there's certain family members that aren't appointed, but they're important, their siblings, their children, it can be useful to keep them in the loop, get their input, make them feel involved, don't exclude them, particularly for end-of-life decision-making, because sometimes that communication can be enough to prevent issues from escalating and turning into a bigger problem.
Well, thank you for that, Lisa. And I guess what you're really saying is people need to go and think about all the ideas that you have suggested. Go find a lawyer where you live and have discussions and make your documents, with the help of a lawyer, of course, as specific and clear as possible so that they have peace of mind and the family also has peace of mind. So thank you for your great insight and for sharing some of your wisdom with us. As a wrap-up, could you share your contact information with our audience?
Certainly. So my website is www.familyhealthlaw.ca, and my phone number and email are all available through the website, but I'll just mention my phone number for anybody taking the notes now. It's 416-937-8768. And I would be pleased to speak with anybody about writing a power of attorney or resolving disputes involving powers of attorney, because in most cases they really can be resolved and we don't have to resort to the court system.
Thank you, Lisa, for that. And to wrap up today's podcast, Chris Catta, one of our board directors, and I have a few closing comments.
Mary, who are our initial project supporters?
We wish to acknowledge that this project is funded in part by the Government of Canada's New Horizons for Seniors program. Our other initial supporters include Care Connect, the Care Guide, the Healing Cycle Foundation, and Scotia Trust. Caregiving Matters is an internet-based registered Canadian charity dedicated to educating and supporting family caregivers. 90% of our work is done online and by leveraging technologies. 10% is done by producing local educational events. We leverage technologies in everything that we do, ensuring greater reach and sustainability. I trust that we have given you some of the highlights of our exciting new initiative. If you are interested in speaking with me about the project, please let me know. We look forward to your questions and your ideas.
Mary, if listeners have questions, what's the best way for them to contact us?
Well, they can contact me, Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. My email is mary@caregivingmatters.ca. Our telephone number is 905-939-2931, and our website is www.caregivingmatters.ca.